Yo, want to help the podcast? Leave an honest review on iTunes, send me proof, and I'll coach up a piece of your writing for up to 2,000 words, or I'll give you a fancy transcript of any single episode of the podcast. That was easy. Let's go. It's that time again. What's up, CNFers, my CNF buddies? This is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, and I'm your radio handsome host, Brendan O'Mara. This is the show where I bring you talented creators of nonfiction, leaders in narrative journalism, essay, memoir, radio, and documentary film, and tease out origins, habits, routines, influences, books, mentors, so that you can pick some of their tools of mastery, add it to your cart, and check out free of charge. That sounds fun, doesn't it? This week, I bring you episode 89 with Sarah Miner, at Sarah Senia Miner on Twitter and Instagram. Well, she's Sarah Senia on Instagram. That's Sarah with an H, C-E-N-I-A, Miner, M-I-N-O-R. She is a professor and a writer, and her essay, Threaded Forms, Decentered Approaches to Nonfiction, looks to knitters, stitchers, and quilting bees to discover new and subversive models for writing memoir. In this episode, we talk about visual essays, how boredom dictates her direction, losing voice and finding it, and the ever-present battle of dealing with social media. Let's do this. So what were your early inspirations when you were even a kid or a teenager, as you were looking to sort of take this road down this particular form of artistic expression? Like, what were some of those formative moments that guided you to where you are right now?
So I probably feel like it's all very accidental, but my mother recently showed me this like a little card you would have gotten in first grade that they would have stuck on a bulletin board outside of a classroom, and it would say Sarah Miner wants to be, and then on the little line afterwards I squeezed in an artist, a seamstress, and a writer. And so she was like you knew. And but apparently, so, you know, after that I forgot for a long time whatever I had known. And you know, in college, I did art history and visual art, and I didn't really even take a creative writing class until my senior year. And that's probably a little bit where I come from, is that I have this background in looking at and thinking about art, and then I make writing now. And so sort of I would say that I would have a hard time not doing that, not making texts and shapes. But it does seem maybe it was rooted in something when I was a child.
Was that something you shared with your mother or grandmother?
So my mother is not crafty. She's a reader, but and she's a medieval scholar, but she's not a maker of things. But yes, my grandmother, you know, when I was young, she and I would embroider, and she had one of those bodies. I didn't know what it was when I was a child, but you know, a body made exactly like her body. So that she wanted to make a dress for herself, she would just build it on that form. And she made my mother's clothes when she was little. And when my grandmother went to college, it was sort of early, and she could still major in home ec. And so that was her major in college, was home economics and sewing primarily.
What do you think it is about those crafts and the textiles that appeals to you so much?
On a very basic level, it is the materials. There's something about engaging with particular materials like fabric or texture that communicate something, I think says something that is harder to communicate in text alone. And I think conceptually, some of the research I've been doing into the history of textile art, the history of fabrics, is all about how those objects are inherently narrative. So not only containing like an archetypal symbol that would suggest a story or remind the viewer of a story, but that they actually had, you know, narrative arcs and plots and characters. And there's this whole, there's now a little field of research into quilt poetics, which is the language of quilts and how certain quilts have jokes in them based on the way they've altered a pattern, or humor based on how they have paired unusual colors. And so it's all based in the idea that quilt patterns are a type of language, and when you speak it, you can notice the variations and that they are actually communicative and narrative. And that really compels me. I like thinking about that, and I like thinking about how texts could do something, could communicate subtly in their forms as well as their language, obviously.
When you approach a piece of writing, and it's something they kind of allude to in your Threaded Forms essay, that are you thinking you've got this idea or a particular scene, and you're like, oh, this might work better as a quilt and a piecing thing, or a knitted type of thing where you don't not sure where it begins and ends, and things that you deconstruct and speak about far more eloquently. But it's, you know, do you go in thinking structure, or do you let the whatever is your inspiration dictate the structure?
Yes, that's a good question. I think I would say I have rarely began with a structure. So I wouldn't say, like, I have a piece I'm working on right now in the shape of a log cabin quilt, and I wouldn't have found that first and then started writing. But it's more, perhaps it's more like I would start writing about something that was compelling me or an argument I had, and then I would get really stuck. Usually, I think this happens to everyone, of course, and there are lots of ways to fight through that or work your way through that. But for me, a really good way to move past that point is to really mess up the form, to put it in something else, and then the text sort of finds its way by the form guiding it in that direction. And so it does seem like it's really about my process. The form is a way to keep going with the text.
Yes, I know, like, John McPhee labors over structure. You know, he'll get his material and then he's like always thinking like how to make this. You know, he might, a fairly arbitrary number, but it might be like 90% of his time is just, before he even starts writing, just thinking about the shape of the piece and how he wants it to look. Do you feel like once you have your material, you spend a long period of time just thinking like, okay, how, let's think and take our time with the shape of this thing, and then that will create its own momentum, and then you can just take off from there?
That's interesting to think about John McPhee. I think I'm also so curious about hearing about other writers' processes, of course, but like, I'm thinking about Joanne Beard. Have you heard this, that when she writes, she only writes one sentence at a time, and once she puts down one sentence, she won't go back and put down the second sentence unless she's really, really sure that's the next one. And then she writes in one direction that way and won't go back. Think of her as one of the more tortured writers in terms of process. And, you know, her sentences are very determined, and they do seem like they always go one after another. But for me, I think probably my process is something of the opposite, where, you know, I have some pieces that are living in the ether that won't progress because I haven't found a form for them to go in. And that means that I'm bored with them. Probably I find them boring because they're not allowing themselves to go into something shapely. And then once they find a shape, it's more of a back and forth process. So I think of myself as someone who takes forever to finish something, though I know it's probably similar for most folks. And part of it for me is that I'll edit the shape as I edit the text, and both have to, you know, come together to make something whole. And that's why I'm often like writing in a design program, which, if you've ever tried it, is maddening.
Wow. No, yeah. Like, what program are you using when you do that?
Often I'll write, I was writing in InDesign for a while, which, you know, seems more intuitive. And now I've been writing in Illustrator. Mm-hmm. So.
Huh. And like, are you able to then, like, take the pencil tool and like draw a shape, and then you can fit words within that? Is that how you go about it?
Yeah, it's usually the tool that's it makes it borders for a section of text, and then I'll edit those borders as I write. And sometimes I'll take the text out and put it in a Word document and work with it for a while and then put it back in the shape. So, yes. Huh. Tedious a lot of the time.
Yeah. So take me back to that moment when, you're in college and you take this creative writing course, you know, something that you, you didn't think that writing might be kind of an option, but something probably happened to you in that course that, you know, turned a switch might have gone on. So, what was that experience like when you were there and, how did that open up the doors of writing as a possible vocation for teaching and also a form of expression for you?
Mm-hmm. So I took that course from Kata Schwain, who's a poet who was at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and now she actually has two books of nonfiction, I believe. But the way she taught the essay was, I think, coming from maybe a poetry background. So the essay was something very fluid that could be shaped, that especially could use the imagination as a way to drive an idea or a scene or something towards the end of it. And that felt, a lot of the ways she talked about the essay were ways I was familiar with talking about art, and it just made a lot of sense for me. And I had been a big reader and I liked books a lot and loved to read. And so it did, things kind of coalesced at that point.
What were you reading up until that point?
I'd taken a semester abroad right before I took Kata's class. And so I was reading books, about the places I was visiting. And so I had read, Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things and this book called Christmas in China. And so it was a lot about writing that was about the context someone had found themselves in, or writing that was about the self, but the self engaged with the world. And so that, I think, got me interested in the essay, which is personal, of course, but I think always in conversation with something larger. Kata taught us from the John DeGatta, The Next American Essay, which I think it's an anthology, but it's making the argument that an essay, has existed in many, many different forms for a long time. It includes The Body by Jenny Bouley, which is just footnotes with the main text redacted. So white space is definitely at play, even in those examples. But for me, I always think about Albert Goldbarth, who's a poet by training, but has a book of essays. And he has this essay called The Flea, and it's in that collection too. Do you know it?
I don't know. Yeah, tell me about it.
It's a personal essay, but it pulls together everything from Dutch painting to the plague to our invention of the microscope and how all of these are related to sex and for him personally and historically. And so it's really winding together some huge frames and lenses down to a personal experience. And I really liked that seemed very artful to me, the pulling together of so many different topics. And so that was, and there's imagined space in there, there's personal scene, there's a lot of research that's pulled in but is made very beautiful. And so a lot of gymnastics going on there in terms of the essay.
What stories really sort of trigger your taste? Like, there's a click that goes on in your head and you're like, oh, that's something that Sarah Minor wants to write about. What are those things that really sort of stick in your craw and you're like, all right, this is something I need to lean into for a while?
Now that I'm working on a project, I'm always on the lookout for an intersection of text and textile, right? So that's, if I were to come across that, that would be very interesting for me. But often, I think it's something, a topic that I write about is often something I've been angry about for some time, and which usually means that it's something I've thought about. I think that emotion makes you think something through in depth. And then usually when I'm writing, it's because I have a question about that, or because I feel like I'm able to just contextualize that question clearly. Not that I really have an answer, but that writing about that will be a question that I clarify and situate in a context. And if I can do that by the end, that's a success, I think. Mm-hmm.
If anger is an inspiration, then what are some things that make you angry?
Well, yeah. So right now, I think I'm writing a little bit about rape narratives, which, yeah, I don't know if you're a Netflixer or movie watcher, but they're very prevalent in a lot of the movies and the stories we look at and share in our culture right now. They're a way often to drive a plot or to catalyze a character to give them motivation to do something, usually to take revenge or take action of some kind. And I don't know if it's angered me, but it is frustrating just to see it happen. It feels very tired, but it's also interesting to us, right? Because it's violent and also usually sexy in some way. And so that's something I'm thinking about and writing about.
What are some of the shows or movies you've seen that might be leaning on that too much as a crutch for revenge and violence? And I think I agree with you that it is kind of a cheap trick to motivate a character. But what are some of the things you're watching that is like spurring this on?
Yeah. I think so. People have talked about this one a lot, but Game of Thrones, of course, has, you know, it's maybe one large rape narrative, the whole series, and then embedded in it are several other small ones. And the makers of the TV show have added additional ones, I think, to, you know, to skip plot holes or push the story along. And so, of course, this doesn't ever mean catalyzing a female character. Usually it means that they're sort of there, the person that's being saved or who is turning someone else to action. There's so many. I think it would be harder to find a television series that is violent and sexual that doesn't have a rape narrative in it that's specifically used to catalyze the plot and not to develop a female character. But I'm thinking about Wind River. Did you see that movie?
No.
Came out last year about ranger in the forest who finds the body of a girl who's kind of frozen in the snow but also dead. And it is about I think it's a movie that wants to be about Native women and how they're not seen or able to speak a lot of the time and are being kind of subsumed by, you know, colonial strategies still. But Native women don't speak in the movie ever. there's not one who has lines. It's mostly about those who are avenging and solving this problem who are, you know, often white. So that's, I think, a really good example.
And your approach, are you using it to use your quilting metaphors or any, are you using a piecing technique or the knitting technique or stitching? Like, maybe you can talk a little bit about those sort of structural devices that you write about in your essay, and then maybe how you're applying some of those tactics to your own essays these days.
Yeah, and I think I'm still thinking through this, but in the Lithead piece, one of the arguments I'm working on is that a lot of the narratives that haven't been able to be shared, a lot of the stories that are lost are ones that can't be told in a linear manner for, you know, several reasons. And right now, and especially recently, I've been thinking about how fragmented forms, you know, something like a braided essay or a collage is rooted in post-colonial literature and queer communities that were often writing back to a power structure. And the form they used to write in was actually fractured as a way of saying, we're not going to write in your style. We're not going to use the rules of narrative that have been applied so far. We're going to actually say something through form and the content. And so it's actually sort of an old way of approaching things, especially if we think about post-colonial writers. And I think I'm especially interested in my role as, you know, a white cis woman in America who's curious about that subject, but I am seeing it resonate in a lot of different ways that you might not expect today. Like, there's this beautiful metaphor for that I've learned from doing some advocacy work, which is that when we try to think about the way a victim of assault or a trauma victim tries to recreate their story and how hard it is for them to do that, often they use the metaphor of a wall of sticky notes that has each sticky note has, you know, something that happened during the event. And for a trauma survivor, it's often like trying to piece that story together via sticky notes. And that's why it comes out so disjointed sometimes, because of the chemicals that are released in your brain as you experience trauma and you have a difficult time storing memories and then putting them back together. So, you know, that reminds me of piecing, of course, putting sections together and making a larger picture that's maybe nonlinear.
What kind of practice do you put in place so you can feel maybe accomplished at the end of the day, you know, so you're getting your work done and so forth, and so you can kind of feel rewarded?
Being a teacher is an interesting role because I think a lot of creative energy does go into your classroom and your students. And so it's often hard for me to go home and write after I teach. But when I do, I really like to write in the evening. I think a lot of folks have trained themselves to ask their brain to work in the very early hours. And that's how they sneak their writing time or they steal their writing time from the world, from the rest of their world. But for me, it is the late hours. And so if I find myself there trying to make something and I can't, or I'm stuck in some way, I've learned, or I know that it means that I haven't been reading enough. And reading really is this, a process that I go back to whenever I can't make or go forward. Sometimes the way I talk about it is that I feel like I've lost my voice when I'm at the computer and nothing's coming out, or everything that comes out feels forced or bad. I feel like I've lost my voice. And so often for me, it's getting quiet enough, you know, waiting for the other voices to go away long enough that I can speak from a place that feels genuine.
Do you feel writing at the end of the day can make it hard for you to find your voice because you've been bombarded with input all day long?
Definitely, yes. Yeah. And sometimes I'll cheat and just read for half an hour before I start. You know, I'll take a half an hour from the time I've set aside just in order to get going, and to make something that feels more worthwhile. But certainly I think, yeah, what you're saying too makes me think about why so many people feel like the first hours are the best. You know, they say you're closer to dreams at that time, perhaps to your subconscious self. And so, yes, that makes sense too.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you like to read before you start writing?
Pretty much anything, but I do have books I go back to. I really love Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts. And I'm leaning over to look at the stack of books on my desk right now. I really like Joanne Beard's The Boys of My Youth. And lately I've been reading Isha Sabatini Sloan's Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, which is a collection of essays that's doing a lot of this pulling different subjects together.
Do you ever struggle with, say, you're reading something of this nature that's very, very polished, and then you go to your own work that maybe you run into a mimicry problem where you're sounding too much like, say, Maggie Nelson and not like yourself and your search for your voice at this time of day? Or is that something you can easily shake off after a page or something?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question, especially because when I'm teaching my students, I often ask them to mimic the writers are reading, you know, take on that voice, speak from that approach to writing. And for me, I think the books that I'm listing, though they're very polished and have a good sense of the line and of their projects, really what I'm always looking to go back to when I read is a book that is very sure of its own voice, that is not concerned with, you know, mimicking another. It has its own distinct style and approach. And so perhaps when I'm going back to that, I'm just reminding myself that that's the way to do it. That's the approach to take.
Right, right. Like, what are some of your, I guess maybe your ambitions and your long-term goals? And with that in mind, like, how do you cultivate a sense of patience to play the long game with your writing?
The long game. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, my ambition. So Yeah, I'd like to have some collections of essays get published in the world that are experimental and take up strange visual spaces, which is, I think, kind of a niche. It's not something every publisher is in, has the capabilities to put out there. It takes a lot of work, I think, to reformat these things for pages and especially to edit them. And I'm working on my writing process as much as my design process. And so it does take some time for me to hone the craft of these things. But long game, I think, I think I have to remind myself that I have to be a little nuts to do this. I think all writers probably have to be a little crazy to convince themselves to keep going. But, right now I'm working with a library to propose to install a bunch of visual essays in their spaces that can be interactive for patrons and read that way and encountered that way. And so I haven't built those things yet. I'm proposing them in order to build them. And so for me, a long game looks like, yes, in terms of pages, a collection, a book length projects, but also this idea of, putting text in space in different ways and asking people to think about what reading looks like, what different kinds of reading looks like.
Do you ever find yourself struggling with looking over your shoulder and comparing yourself to other writers, younger or even a little older, and you like kind of wonder like, oh, like how are they able to do what they're doing at this such and such an age? And when I was at that point, like I was this little seed and somehow they feel anointed. Like, do you ever find yourself with that kind of that jealousy struggle sometimes? Or have you been able to avoid that altogether?
Oh yeah, I think that's definitely most of those thoughts are unavoidable, especially when you're in, a writing world where a lot of those things are pretty visible. And the conversations I have with a bunch of my writing community and my friends are about, I think, the role of literary Twitter and how it can really send people down those spirals. And that engaging deeply with the conversations on Twitter can make you, I think it does keep you very informed. It lets you know about new works that are coming out, important conversations that are being had. But for most people I know, it really freezes them up or makes them afraid to write because they're thinking about the context in which their writing will be received before making the writing itself. And so, like, for instance, I've really tried to disengage from those platforms, though, of course, not all the way. But I think, I just started this new job in Cleveland this year, and I'm pretty young to be an assistant professor. And a lot of the ways I've kept going is by really just thinking about where I'm at right now and trying not to think about what the result will be, because that would freeze me up also. It'd make me unable to really make my work to write in my voice, as I've been trying to say, I think.
Yeah, because I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who's an illustrator and painter yesterday, and she's just in this weird place where she has like this almost deep anxiety about being able to. She's kind of burned out, but she doesn't feel like she deserves to step away from it because she's, gonna lose her edge, but she's running the car into the ground, and then it's just this. It's this thing where she's kind of growing resentful of the work itself, and it's a part of it has a lot to do with looking at everyone's highlight reels on Instagram or Twitter and compared to the muddy shit that you're stuck in, and then it just kind of heightens the level of anxiety that you're not doing enough and you're not accomplished enough, and you said that with literary Twitter and everything, it's kind of the same way. You're seeing everyone's A game, but you're not seeing, the, to borrow a baseball term, like the 500 swings going on in your
Perfect.
basement.
Exactly. Yes. And I have a mentor, Eric LeMay, who is an essayist and does some cool, really cool visual essay work too. And he his approach to teaching, I think, is to know that all students and all writers, I think, at every level of the profession are in some way limited. The possibilities for what they're going to do are limited by all the pressures of the outside world, be it Twitter or the critiques they're getting or the other things they're reading that are making them question the work they're making. And he famously says that writers require leisure to do their work. So not that it's taking a break ever, not that it's going on a vacation from your work, but you actually need it as part of your process to digest what you're doing and think back. And for me, I think leisure from Twitter a lot of the time, like vacationing from those outside energies that would limit me in other ways. And my friend Misty Morrison, who's a painter, always tells her students that when they're stuck with what they're doing, when they're, you know, they're tired of it, they don't want to make it anymore, they should go to the hobbies that are their secret hobbies. So what they really make on the side, like if you're a journalist who writes poems, or if you're an essayist who's secretly doing watercolors, do that for a while. And that's, you know, the making energies are still moving, but you are giving yourself leisure time from whatever you feel stuck with.
What are some things that you like to do that's part of your process away from the computer that helps inform your writing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think I really used to think and tell myself that all of my writing began with heavy research, that, you know, that's kind of the field I came from. The way I learned to first put things on paper was in art history. And so I still, you know, whenever I'm writing an essay, I still come back from the library where I'm teaching, at the school where I'm teaching, with a huge stack of books, like crusty old books on subjects with, you know, beautiful old dated approaches to them or really smart arguments. And so sometimes for me, it's like having my own thought, my own usually frustration, and then sitting with ways that other people have thought about that and either writing back to that or writing against some of those things. That helps a lot with my process. Are you asking too about like I do embroidery on the side, or I will mess around with quilting that I sometimes put in my work when writing is bothering me.
And you mentioned earlier too about sort of mitigating or limiting social media and so forth, because that's it's great in a sense because it can connect us, but at the same time can be incredibly toxic depending which sort of rivers you paddle down. And how do you balance those aspects of the sort of the need and the utility of your Twitters and Facebooks and Instagram versus unplugging and being able to just step aside and do the work and do deep work, as Cal Newport might say, who's a best-selling author, gets a ton of work done, ton of books, ton of research, ton of teaching with no social media platform at all. So like, how do you strike a balance?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think it's probably different for everyone, but I'm certainly not saying I'm totally disengaged. No way. But for me, it's being willing to be a little less informed sometimes, you know, or playing catch up when I go back to it, being informed in retrospect about things. And, you know, I am so much more deeply embedded in the writing world with writers. You know, most of my close friends are writers, people I talk to daily are writers. And so I find that it's more productive for me to work out a lot of the ideas that are current or problems that I'm thinking through by hashing them out with those real people, you know, over long conversations, and then kind of going back to whatever's going on in a much more, I think, snacky way on social media feeds. And yeah, I feel like I really, you know, it helps my writing and my sense of my voice to also have real deep conversations and arguments and hash things out with those folks. And then know that they're also going on those platforms online.
Yeah. Are these in-person conversations or digital?
Yeah, I guess they're mostly in person. My partner is a writer, and then two of my very best friends are writers as well. So, you know, sometimes it's arguments that we're in. We'll be in, you know, these like days long arguments about something, and we'll both come to a better understanding of our own thoughts and probably change our minds as well. So,
yeah, with your work, you know, what do you feel like you struggle with the most?
I think it's probably what I've struggled with since I was young and what I probably always will struggle with, which is ending, deciding when something is finished or when I've said it clearly enough. I think I could, you know, there's an essay I've been writing for a year and a half now, like really grinding on, and I don't think it's finished. But I think sometimes finished can mean you worked it to a certain point and that you don't want to overwork it. And that's something I'm trying to learn for myself.
Is it because you have perfectionist tendencies that you just want to keep shaping it and shaping it?
Probably. I don't know. I think I'm, you know, not as detail oriented as you would think a person who writes in a design program would be. It's that, but it's also that I'm probably trying to do a Goldbarth type thing where I'm pulling in, you know, research, my own voice, scenes, memories, all these different materials, and also asking them to live in this strange form. And so there are just so many elements fighting against each other a lot of the time. And a lot of my work is to make them feel seamless, and that, you know, when does that end? I think I wonder that if they're so different from the start and you want them to remain distinct, I don't know when that ends.
What are some of the conversations you've had with your friends about finishing things and knowing when things are over?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's something I talk a lot about with my students too. And that is, in nonfiction, especially when you're writing something that's more essayistic, or there's a personal narrative to it, of course, that moves through time and relies on action and dialogue, but there's also outside elements that are in conversation with that. What is an ending? What does it look like? How do you manufacture the feeling of conclusion when all those materials are at work? And I think that sometimes I've seen it done in a scene that pulls, you know, it's a final action. It's sort of like a fireworks moment. You know, it's over because there's a big bang, or it can feel more like the end of a research paper where you actually come to some concrete conclusion in an essayist voice that's outside of scene. And that's what feels conclusive, but it seems like it's different for each piece that a person writes. And so with my students, I used to joke that in nonfiction, you know, not everyone dies at the end or gets married at the end. You could say that they did, but it's usually there's something else that you have to pull together in terms of giving the reader, yeah, something finalized, something they feel like they've finished by the time they leave. So it's different for every piece, it seems.
Yeah, and it could be too that depending on the piece, it almost feels like it never ends, because there's a point in the essay that you write that some of the best things that you've ever read are things where as soon as you've reached the final full stop, you want to go right back to the beginning of the essay and like start it over. So yeah, it's like, in a sense, like some are just, they just keep going and going, and that's okay. And that's actually a testament to the writer to be able to, it just makes you want to swing back to the beginning and just start over again.
Right. Yes. I think about that a lot. And I think that comes back to what we've been talking about with narrative, where if we think of a story or an essay or an article as something that moves from a beginning to an end, that's actually one way of thinking about how a life is lived or how a thought is experienced or something like that. And if an ending is more fuzzy, or if, as you're saying, it doesn't end, it's just that we've paused in a longer moment, then maybe the form or the ending would look different. Feel different.
Very nice. And so let's get a little technical with some things, tactical, if you will. What are, you know, when you're getting into an essay that has some research component to it, how are you recording interviews or organizing your notes? Like, how are you building sort of your palette so you can start to get the work done?
Yes. So, I mean, I've written essays where I've done long interviews, and I've usually recorded those on like an audio device. Mm-hmm. So that I have them later and ask for permission, obviously, before I begin that. Or I correspond with people by email, and then I have their written responses a lot. I find that writers, especially writers, like sometimes prefer to be to be asked about their work and their very deep secrets or something over email. And so that's been useful for me in the past. You know, a lot of my work is not journalistic in that manner, though. So even though I would have used a process that I know is fair and moral as a way to gather information, those interviews would then be woven into a piece where, you know, their attributions would be in a footnote or in a side column or worked in a different manner than they would in an article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you have those recordings, do you transcribe your own recordings or do you have someone else do it or a service?
Yes, I would transcribe my own.
Do you hate it like I hate it?
It takes so much time, right?
Yes.
It's incredible how much time it takes. Yeah.
It's a big reason why the podcast right now doesn't really have a lot of transcripts because me it's a 3-to-1 thing. If it's an hour long, it's going to take me at least 3 hours.
Oh my gosh. That seems fast actually to me that it would take 3 because you can't type at the rate of a voice.
No. And I hear having a foot pedal helps because you can keep your hands free. And pause the recording and record with your feet.
Oh, wow. Okay, so we just need more limbs for this.
Yeah, you have to be like a drummer.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it's a grind. If that 3-to-1 ratio seems fast, that's only fast because of newspaper stuff I've done and been on newspaper. So you gotta be going pretty quick, especially mm-hmm. if you have recordings on deadline. And do you choose to outline? Do you use or do you kind of just have it in your head and try to manifest it on the page after?
I used to outline, you know, especially if I would write, like sometimes I'll write a critical article or I think I did make an outline for the piece on text and textiles that we're chatting about. But for creative work, I think no, never, because I'm really always interested in where I'm going, and if I know where I'm going to end, then I get bored pretty quickly with the writing because it does feel like a process of discovery for me.
Right. Yeah. So in a way it's like you got to leave open the possibility for spontaneity in a way. And when you sit down to write in the evenings, how long do you typically go before you kind of get tired? Do you just go for, can you go for hours or do you write in little spurts?
Historically, what I would like best to do is to sit down and write for like 4 or 5 hours. I think for me, that's what I would like to do. That doesn't work out very often because I love to really be immersed in a project. And I think sometimes it's hard to find your way out or find a way to draw everything together unless you are really deep in the consciousness of that project. And so it has been hard for me, especially as I've been teaching more, as I've been traveling, to sneak in those little bits of time and feel like I'm still progressing forward at a rate that feels good. And so I think for me, the fact that I am no longer writing in long chunks of time is actually changing the shape of my writing. It's meaning that I have smaller sections that I write at a time and don't really worry about the trajectory, which is probably also why I'm avoiding outlines.
What part in the process would you say you feel most engaged and most alive in?
I really love when I have a very messy draft with writing I would be ashamed to show anyone, and then I go back to it and I guess you would call it editing or rewriting. For me, that's really what writing is the rewriting and rewriting and rewriting of a piece and honing it down. And so that's when I feel like I have steam to go forward. It's much harder for me when I am starting at the beginning with not a lot of material on the pages yet. And I think it's not for me, like I couldn't just sit down and bang out a bunch of things and then shape from there. I think I have to be pretty intentional with what I put down in order for it to have a direction. And so that's maybe why the first part is so feels tedious for me sometimes. Yes.
And what books do you find yourself rereading over and over again to kind of teach you, like, or remind you that, like, oh, you know, that's how it's done, and when I'm on my game, I can do that too.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about those, like, the Argonauts is one I go back to a lot. Lately, I've been looking at, Elena Skilianos's You Animal Machine, and it's Eleni Skilianos. It's a Greek name. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly.
And how do you try to avoid the feelings of self-doubt, and what kind of self-talk do you use when you, like, you're a bit down or in a creative funk to kind of pull yourself up out of that kind of rut and mud?
Yeah, I think I just really try to be present with the place that I am currently and try to avoid thinking about, you know, things I wanted to achieve by this point, but feel like I haven't or feel like I'm behind on. You know, I have a creative dissertation due a year from now, and it feels like the timeline is coming up pretty quickly. And so thinking about that timeline, right, I'm not going to do work by thinking about that timeline, but yeah. I forget about it for a while, I might actually get something done. And so it really is for me about focusing on the present moment, what I'm doing now, what interests me right now, not what I should be researching for the next piece or not the deadline that's coming.
And you said you look at some other, like, visual forms of things for inspiration. Are there any, like, you know, documentary films or podcasts or radio that you also listen to and consume as a way, like, oh, that, you know, if I do it as well as they're doing that podcast, I can make my sort of visual essays better?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love documentaries. I recently watched, have you seen the documentary Tickled?
No. But I'm going to now.
Yeah, it's pretty dark. But it was, I think, watching documentarians put their things together makes me think a lot about the essay and about nonfiction and the approaches you can take while doing it. I think in that documentary, they really broke the fourth wall, or it's probably more like the fifth wall, by bringing in the subject of their documentary, who showed up at the Sundance showing of the film, and they include these interviews with him and his being present. And so, yeah, that was like a very interesting, I think, an interesting moment for nonfiction and reporting and documentary that happened. And it's about what started out as competitive tickling. So men who were hired to see how long they could be tickled and withstand it, but then that became quickly pornographic, and they were, you know, sort of held hostage for the videos they had made by the maker. I don't want to spoil it for you, but Okay. Yeah, it's a dark, dark film.
Wow.
But very interesting, well made, I think, and they do. Yeah, there's a lot that you get to see about the process that's cool. And then also, I really love the New Yorker Fiction podcast, where they have folks come on and read. And I've actually, my partner and I have taken some very long road trips over the past 2 years, and some of my work has started while I've been frantically scribbling in the passenger seat, you know, right after one of those, or even during them, when I feel like I've, you know, done that thing where I hear someone really writing from a voice that is theirs and not thinking about the pressures that would be reshaping that or questioning that. Or yeah, I really love listening to work aloud. It's like reading, but sometimes better.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any points of grammar or craft that you coach people on, that's like maybe a real simple tweak that you see that a lot of people might be making a mistake on, but it's something that, you know, when done well, it's something that can really make somebody's writing pop.
Yeah, I'm not sure about something at the line level that you're talking about as much. I often coach my students into repetition. So if it feels like they haven't found a voice, it feels like they don't know what direction they're going in with the piece they're writing, we'll ask them to repeat some way they're structuring a sentence. So very basically down to the way the sentence is built. And if they do that a few times, it both makes them think about what they have written, how they are putting thoughts together, what their voice is, and how it is developed by that sentence. But also, if they leave it, it looks like they're doing something intentional, right? And then they're like, oh, right, I have intentions. I should communicate to my audience that, you know, I'm taking us somewhere. I know what I'm doing. And that sometimes means writing through it and finding the intention and being able to go back and signal what it is. So.
And when you feel overwhelmed or unfocused, what do you do to maybe get back on track?
With writing.
Yeah, or it can be, you know, even outside of writing, you know, because I think a lot of us are bombarded with a lot of stuff, and anything that can help sort of defrag our own mental computers can really help us get to a better creative headspace. So I wonder, you can take that any way you'd like, but whatever way you're comfortable answering.
Yeah, so my friends would tell you that I'm notoriously hard to reach by telephone, and that's because I often leave my phone away from myself, you know, in a room, very literally under a pillow with the sound off, because, you know, it's very tempting. If you've encountered something difficult, if you're stressed out, if you don't want to do your work, it's easy to sit down with your phone and look up an hour later and think, where have I been? Those moments usually make me feel like very lost, or like I'm this is, something's wrong here. Like I'm not using a process that's actually getting me anywhere. I'm just sort of checking out. And so I think checking out can be great, you know, really useful sometimes. I still do lose hours to the internet and my phone, but yeah, I think I do often put it away. And that's also a way of, you know, me disengaging from social media for a day or a few days, is just literally having it out of reach, out of sight. And that helps check in.
Yeah, because then if you get into that hole of that downward spiral of that, and then you look up and it's an hour later and you just feel like shit. You're like guilty. Like, I just blew all that time and I should have been doing this, and now I feel like garbage. And then you're just in a horrible space to keep going forward, and then you just give up and move on to the next day, maybe.
Yeah, that, and I think that cycle, you know, I've gone through that cycle many times, especially probably before this year when I really started putting things away. But I think for me, if I look up from my phone, because it does happen, if I look up from my phone and I'm like, oh, an hour, 2 hours has gone by, something like that, my phone's dying, that's why I'm looking up from it. I think, okay, what am I actually avoiding right now? Because it's usually not work that's coming up. It's something that I've experienced that day that I'm trying not to think about, or that my brain is sort of like, I can't deal with this right now. And so that for me is a signal to be like, hey, you're supposed to be, there's something you actually need to process that you're not. And so put this away and figure out what that is.
Very nice. Sarah, why don't you tell us where we can find out more about you and your work, like your website and when you're allowing yourself to be on the digital platforms, where people can find you online.
Sure. I have a website, that's sarahseniaminor.com. I have a Twitter that is like very irregularly updated. and then, yeah, like I'll be at some panels at AWP this year, and I'll be giving a reading in Flagstaff this year. And I'm at the Cleveland Institute of Art, where we're doing some really cool stuff with creative writing and visual art these days. So.
Very nice. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for carving some time out of your morning. This is a lot of fun getting to know you a little more and get familiar with your work and your process and everything. So this is a lot of fun. Your essay in the magazine was brilliant. And so just from one writer to another, just keep doing what you're doing. And thanks for your work.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation, Brendan. And you too. Keep doing your work. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Alas, we've come to the end. Thanks again to Sarah Miner. Be sure to give her follows on Instagram at Sarah Senia and Twitter at Sarah Senia Miner. Thanks again to Sarah. That was good. I had fun. It was fun, right? You like me. Whatever. Okay, if you go over to brendanomera.com, you'll be able to sign up for my monthly reading list newsletter that has book recommendations and what you might have missed from the world of the podcast. Also some documentary film and any other cool nonfiction-y stuff I stumble across. It's once a month, no spam, and you can't beat it. You can say hi to me on Twitter and Instagram at brendanomera, at cnfpod is the podcast Twitter page, and at CNF Podcast is the Facebook page. Wow, that's annoying. You'll find me hawking over all those territories all the time, so you have innumerable ways to say hello. I am done. Have a CNF and great week, friends. Goodbye.